If you would please open your Bibles to the Old Testament book of Joshua. Joshua is one of my favorite Old Testament books. As Randy has mentioned, I seem to select the one that I'm currently studying from to be the favorite. But Joshua is a fascinating book for many reasons, because it describes the entrance into the promised land under the leadership of this great leader, Joshua. And as we turn in our Bibles, look, if you will, first of all, in Joshua chapter 6. Well, I tell you what, before we do that, let's look at Joshua chapter 1 and talk for just a moment about who Joshua is. In Joshua chapter 1, we note that Moses has died and Joshua now becomes the leader of this great people. Specifically in verse 4, God said to Joshua, "From this wilderness," or from the wilderness and this Lebanon, "even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your border." Now, you can look at a map, as we will in just a moment, and notice the land that God had promised to give unto Abraham. And as we look at that land, we see that it's very vividly described here in Joshua chapter 1. Joshua is to be the one who would lead them into that land. In verse 6, it says, "Be strong and of good courage, for thou shalt cause this people to inherit the land which I swear unto their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous to observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest have good success whithersoever thou goest." The instructions of God unto this great leader are very clear. You do what I tell you to do. You lead the people into the promised land and all will be well. As we look in Joshua chapter 6 now. In Joshua chapter 6, they come to the first city of the conquest of this great land. Now you may remember that in Joshua chapter 4, Joshua chapter 5, Joshua leads them across the Jordan into the promised land, and they set up camp in a place called Gilgal. And then they go to fight against the city of Jericho by the instructions of the Lord. In chapter 6, beginning at verse 1, it says, "Now Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And Jehovah said unto Joshua, See, I have given into thy hand Jericho, the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor, and ye shall compass the city, all the men of war going about the city once. Thus shalt thou do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And the 7th day ye shall compass the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horns, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat, and the people shall go up every man straight before him." Now we read this passage as a very familiar text, do we not? The instructions of Joshua, or God to Joshua, regarding the fall of the city of Jericho. When we turn over to a little bit later in this chapter, we see that they did just exactly what God said, and the walls fell down, and every man went up straight before him. And as I understand that, he didn't have to look for a hole in the wall. The walls fell completely down all the way around the city of Jericho. As we come into the New Testament, we notice in Hebrews chapter 11 that by faith the walls of Jericho fell. And there's a lesson in that as we talk about what faith is, and we see what Joshua led the people to do, noting that God said, "I have given thee the city," but yet it was not without condition. There were some things they had to do, and when they went in and did just exactly what God said, the walls fell down flat and every man went up straightway. But you see on the board, we're going to be talking this evening the story of Achan. This morning we talked about Lot, and I think there are some fascinating lessons when we talk about individual characters in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, and we've had series of lessons discussing characters, but I want to talk about this one tonight. And I was trying to think as I was preparing for tonight's lesson, something, as I was mentioning to Richard earlier, something that would complement the lesson that we talked about this morning as we talked about Lot and the mistakes that he made. A good man, but yet he just made some very poor decisions. And I was trying to decide how to title this lesson. As we talk about the story of Achan, Well, would I call him a bad man who made some bad decisions? Well, perhaps so, but the Scriptures do not identify him with the word bad or evil or wicked to the extent that we can put that on the chart. We see what he did was wicked. What he did was in disobedience to God. But as opposed this morning to our study, 2 Peter chapter 2, the text tells us three times that Lot was righteous. You don't find any such designation like that in this text about Achan. But I do want to call your attention to some things that depict Achan as very foolish. Yes, he made some horrible, horrible decisions. But as we look at what Achan saw, perhaps here is a thing that we ought to draw our attention to. When you consider that those who crossed over the Red Sea into the wilderness of Sinai, and when you consider their lack of faith, their murmuring and their complaining and so forth, and how that God said that everybody that's 20 years old and older are going to perish in the wilderness. Well, the very fact that we read about Achan coming into the promised land tells us that he was younger than 20 when they crossed over the Red Sea. Now, can you imagine as a young man seeing that great event? Somebody said, well, maybe he was too young to remember. Well, then we have the 40 years of wilderness wandering. What happens in 40 years? Well, people grow up, don't they? And in 40 years, people marry. They have children, as we see in this case with Achan. But what happened in their relationship with God during that 40 years? Well, their clothes didn't wear out. God provided them food to eat. He provided them water to drink, all miraculously. Do you suppose that old Achan has seen any of that, the miracles that God provided for them in order that they might live during this 40 years? But what else has Achan seen? He's one in this crowd who has crossed the Jordan River, coming into the promised land. The Jordan River, during its flood stages, is stopped, and the people of Israel cross over, the text tells us, on dry ground. Did Achan see that? Well, yes, he's in the land. Surely he crossed over the Jordan River on dry ground during its flood stages. This is what Achan saw. Now, when we read in Joshua chapter 6, what else has Achan seen? You don't conquer a city by marching around it. You conquer a city by brute military force. But that's not how Jericho was conquered. What has Achan seen? He's seen the walls of Jericho fall. And seen those walls fall without any brute military strength. He saw God defeat that city. Now what else do we see about Achan? Read further with me, if you will, in Joshua chapter 6. In Joshua chapter 6, beginning in verse 17, it said, "And the city shall be devoted, even it and all that is therein, to Jehovah. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the devoted thing, lest when ye have devoted it, ye take of the devoted thing, so would ye make the camp of Israel accursed and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of brass and iron are holy unto the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord." Now what is it that the Lord said about the spoils of the city of Jericho? You don't touch it. You don't take it. That belongs to me. That'll be put into the treasury of the Lord as the first fruits of the land of conquest. Do you think Achan had some problem understanding that? From all of the miracles that he has witnessed firsthand, and as he has now come into the promised land and marches through the city of Jericho, what is it that Achan did? Well, if you'll read in verse 1 of chapter 7, it says, "But the children of Israel committed trespass in the devoted thing, for Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah of the tribe of Judah, took of the devoted thing, and the anger of Jehovah was kindled against the children of Israel." Well, we don't have to wonder long about what Achan did. But you know, the rest of the people of Israel did. They had to wonder for some time about what's wrong. Because as you read in the 7th chapter, we know that it wasn't long after the conquering of the city of Jericho that they march over to the city here of Ai, not all that far away. And when they come to the city of Ai, they are sadly defeated. The city was much smaller than that of Jericho. And rather than to send in the whole army, they only sent in a small portion of their army. But yet we note that about 3,000 of that army who went in, their multitudes of them were killed. Now I say multitudes, if you look at verse 5 by way of comparison, it says, the men of Ai smote of them about 36 men, and they chased them from before the gate unto Shibarim, and smote them at the descent, and the hearts of the people melted and became as water. How many soldiers did they lose at Jericho? None. When they come to the smaller city, the city of Ai, now they've lost 36. When you consider that a multitude, from the perspective of Israel it was, and they are bewildered. Why is it that we were not successful in conquering this smaller city? In verse 6 it says, and Joshua rent his clothes and fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of Jehovah until the evening, he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust upon their heads. And Joshua said, alas, O Lord, wherefore hast thou at all brought this people over the Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites, to cause us to perish? Would that not have been, we had been content and dwelt beyond the Jordan? O Lord, what shall I say after that Israel had turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and will compass us round and cut off our name from the earth. And what wilt thou do for thy great name? You see Joshua's concern. We'll be held in scorn among the people of the land. And what about the name of the Lord? The name of the Lord will be despised as well. So what's wrong? God said to him, get up. Wherefore art thou fallen upon thy face? Israel has sinned, verse 11. Yea, they have even transgressed my covenant which I commanded them, saying, they have even taken of the devoted thing, and have also stolen and dissembled also, and they have put it among their own stuff. And he says, so I won't be with you anymore. Now we know that Achan is the man, but Israel didn't know that. And so they were to seek out and find out who it was that committed this sin at Ai, at Jericho, causing the people to be defeated at Ai. Now we've noted in Joshua chapter 7 and verse 1 who it was that did that. Achan did. But notice, if you will, that God said, the children of Israel have sinned. Well, we know that there's one that did this. But yet, though there is one that committed this sin, all Israel has a price to pay for what this one did. I'll tell you what, folks, when I was in school, one of the things that often annoyed me was when one student in the class would do something terrible and then the whole class would be punished for it. I thought, well, now that's not fair. Until I realized that there are many things in life that's just not fair. Why not just seek out the one and punish the one? Well, here there is a lesson to be learned, isn't there? And isn't that what we try to teach the class? Here is a practice that has characterized this one student, but that's not to be you. You can't do that. There are consequences. So we want that lesson driven home. And that's what we see with the children of Israel. There was sin among them. Now we know who that is. Turn, if you will, to Joshua chapter 7 and begin reading, if you would please, in verse 16. Joshua chapter 7, verse 16. So Joshua rose up early in the morning and brought Israel near by their tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. And he brought near the family of Judah, and he took the family of the Zerahites. And he brought near the family of the Zerahites, man by man, and Zabdi was taken. And he brought near his household, man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. Now that, again, is very interesting to me, because you see this somewhat like a funnel, just funneling down to one man. Now do you think that Achan, for a moment, didn't see what was happening? The tribe of Judah was brought forth. The family of the Zerahites was brought forth. And the family of the Zerahites was brought forth man by man. Don't Achan know that before long, he individually, personally, is going to have to explain this thing? But what has he seen? All of the miracles of God. How long has he seen them? 40 plus years. Now what did he do? Well, if you'll notice his account, beginning in verse 19. Joshua said unto Achan, "My son, give, I pray thee, glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and make confession unto him, and tell me now what thou hast done. Hide it not from me." And Achan answered Joshua and said, "Of a truth I have sinned against Jehovah the God of Israel, and thus have I done. When I saw among the spoil a goodly Babylonian mantle and 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, I coveted them and took them, and behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it." Now there's our lesson. There's our outline in verse 21. Achan, what did you do? Achan has confessed. "When I came through the city, I saw among the spoil, a goodly Babylonian mantle, a beautiful garment." He said, "I saw 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight." Now, much like Lot, how is Achan reasoning now about the things that he saw? "How rich I would be if I took them." And so he said, "I coveted them and took them. And behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it." I want to examine each of those things that Achan reports to Joshua. I think there are lessons in each one. You can make a series out of that. We'll try not to do that tonight. But Achan said, "I saw." Isn't that how often temptation begins? And certainly that's how temptation originated. As you turn back in your Bible to Genesis chapter 3, in Genesis chapter 3, Satan had said to Eve, "Is there a tree in the midst of the garden of which thou mayest not freely eat?" And Eve correctly said, "Yes, there's one in the midst of the garden." God said, "We can't eat of it." And furthermore, he said, "In the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." Did Eve have that about right? Yeah, she's got a good understanding of what God said. Now, if you look in verse 3, verse 4. "The serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be open, and ye shall be as God, knowing good and evil." And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, you think Eve hadn't seen that tree before? There it is. She knew where it was, in the midst of the garden. See, we're not to partake of that. God said, if we partake of that, then we'll surely die. We're not to eat of it. We're not to touch it. Well, now, how can you not eat of it or not touch it if you don't know where it is? She knew where it was. But the verse tells us that when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat. She saw these things. Now I want to ask you, do you suppose that she's taking a second look at the tree? Now that's what we want to think about. You see, Satan said, "God knows that you'll not die. You'll become as gods." All right. So let's look at it again from a little different perspective, you see. She saw that it was good for food. Aforetime she had seen that it had been forbidden by God. Can't touch it lest you die. But now she takes another look. It's good for food. And it's very pretty to look at. And it's desired to make one wise. Well, I got a whole new perspective on that tree. And that's what Achan said. "I saw." Now you think Achan had never seen anything before that God had delivered? Why, absolutely. He had seen the miracles of God. The prohibition of God regarding the things of the city of Jericho. Achan understood that just like Eve understood this. But he said, "I saw it." And when you turn further in your Bible to 2 Samuel chapter 11, we read about King David. King David, 2 Samuel chapter 11. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, beginning at the early part of that chapter, we learn that others were out, other kings, out engaged in war. But the passage tells us in the last statement of verse 1 that David tarried at Jerusalem. You know the story. Verse 2. And it came to pass at even that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. Now you know what happened to David? David saw this beautiful woman, and he sent for her. He lusted for her, and he was not the only one at fault. She came. And David committed the sin of adultery with her. A child was conceived. And then we learn that David began to try to dodge the consequences of what he did. But where did it all start? David looked upon this woman. He ought not be engaging upon her. There are numerous warnings. We've selected two. In Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 25, the wisdom writer said, "Lust not after her beauty in thy heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids." Well, the point being, you don't need to cast your eyes upon her and just stare at her, because her beauty can be deceitful. And what did the Lord say? "But I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." The Lord had said, or was to say after this in Matthew the 15th chapter, that every sin that man commits, beginning in verse 18, is the result of what he thinks in his heart. And of course the wisdom writer said, "As a man thinketh within himself," or within his heart, "so is he." Now where has David allowed himself to go when he gazes upon this woman? I find it fascinating that as we look at that expression, let's close that for a moment. As we look at that expression, we want to be sure that our little ones understand the song. Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see. Oh, be careful, little hands, what you do. Oh, be careful, little feet, where you go. Don't we teach our little ones hear that song? Well, certainly we do. But then by what reason do we think that once we reach the ripe old age of 21, we can just see anything we want to? We can go anywhere we want to. We can put our hands just anywhere we desire, and it's not going to have any effect of harm upon us. Now, that's just ludicrous. Would you say with Achan, that'd be foolish? That's just foolish to reason that way. And so Achan saw these things. But next he said, "I coveted them." Do you see that there in the text? Now that's a word that we probably don't use as much as we should. But the word literally means to take pleasure in, to desire, to lust, to covet, to be desirable, to desire passionately. Now it's kind of a sore spot with me when a dictionary uses the word that you're trying to define to tell you what that word means. But I want to go with this last expression. To be desirable, or to desire passionately. In other words, I want it. And I want it so bad, I'll almost do anything in order that I can have it. You ever want something that bad? Sometimes my mother used to use the expression that she wanted something so bad she'd just give her eye teeth for it. Well, that's wanting it pretty bad. When we look at old Achan here, we see this man as one who could be represented like that. I want that. I've just got to have it. Now friend, if you don't believe that desire can be compelling, why in the world is there such a thing called advertising? What is advertising? It's to create within you a passion, a desire for something, so that you'll go out and buy it. Now back when I was growing up, I forget what model of car it was. Some of you fellows could probably help me with that. But they were advertising a car as being a very sexy car. I thought at the time, what's sexy about a car? But why were they using that word? Because it sells. It sells. It advertises something in a light that causes you to want that product, doesn't it? Now, if that not be not true, then why do we see that attached to so many products that have nothing in the world to do with anatomy or anything related to it? Well, you see, the folks who advertise know that sex sells. And so if we can get you to see something and associate it with that line of thought, then you'll want it. You'll want to go out and buy it. Now, what did David do with Bathsheba? He saw her, and the text tells us that he lusted. Do you see that? He lusted. He was determined then. He had to have her. To lust is to desire passionately. And so David determined that he had to have her, and he sent a messenger for her that she would come and lay with him. Now, beloved, as we look at David, we know that the law had said a long time before, thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. When consequences of David's sins were pronounced upon him in chapter 8, we learn that the prophet told him that God would have given you anything that you wanted. He would have given or multiplied to you wives, but you weren't happy with that. You had to go out and take this man's wife. And you remember how that Nathan the prophet told David that as he described this man that had one little ewe lamb that he treasured that was to him as a daughter, and yet there was a rich man who had a guest, and he come and got that poor man's lamb and killed it for his guest. And David was very angry. And Nathan the prophet said, thou art the man. That's what you did. Now that's where covetous leads. I've just got to have it. I want it. And I want it so bad, I'll be just guilty of doing just about anything in order that I can get it. Now that's contrary to the attributes that God desires for His children to have. In Hebrews chapter 5, or chapter 13, verse 5, the writer said, be ye free from the love of money, content with such things as you have. For Himself has said, I will in no wise fail thee, neither will I in any wise forsake thee. We see the evils of love attached to money. Not that money's wrong, and not the desire of being ambitious is wrong, but the love of money, this passionate desire to acquire it, to the extent that we'll do just about anything in order to get it, is sinful, beloved. Paul said from a Roman prison that he had learned how to have a lot. He'd learned how to abound. He had learned how to be abased, how to be in want. But he said, I've learned in whatsoever state I am in, therein to be content. Contentment. Sometimes it's hard to find to be content. Achan was not content with the miracles that God had wrought. He was not content with the deliverance of the city of Jericho into the hands of the Israelites. He had to have the things for his very own that God said were his be cast into the treasury. So as Achan came through the city and saw the garment, saw the gold, saw the silver, he said, I had to have it. I coveted it. And we know that covetousness is idolatry. We have Colossians 3, verse 5. That's all I need to say about that. That's what the verse simply says. All covetousness is idolatry. Now sometimes we think that idolatry is shaping something of stone or metal and putting it upon a stand and bowing down before it and calling it God or worshiping it in some way. There are all kinds of things that can become an idol to us. Even our own desires. And so that's why Paul said covetousness is idolatry. Achan said, I coveted. Now that becomes somewhat of an elaborate theme that we could discuss at length. We'll try not to do that this evening. But we need to see that that's described in Luke chapter 12. We mentioned that this morning regarding the two brothers who were fighting about the inheritance. And Jesus cautioned them, keep yourselves from all covetousness. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things which he possesses. The sum total of your life is not what you own. But you see, Achan had missed that. He somehow thought that the beautiful, expensive garment from Babylon and the gold and the silver, that somehow made him rich if he had those in his possession. Jesus said in verse 21 of our illustration, regarding this rich man who said, I have much riches or many riches laid up for many years, I will take my ease, eat, drink, and be merry. God called him a fool. And he said, so is he who lays up treasure for himself. Now, that was the problem Lot had, wasn't it? For himself, and is not rich toward God. Now, what did Achan do? Achan said, I saw it. He said, I just had to have it. I coveted it. And then he said, I took it. Now, you would expect that to be the next step, wouldn't you? I saw it. I wanted it. And so I just took it. Now, James tells us that there is a progress or a progression to the commitment of sin. In James chapter 1, reading beginning in verse 14, James said, but each man is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. Then the lust, when it hath conceived, beareth sin. And the sin, when it is full grown, bringeth forth death. Don't we see that with Achan? Don't we see that with David? And don't we see that with Eve? Sin is progressive. You see, sin is not committed at the point of temptation. We've talked about that earlier. In James chapter 1, beginning in verse 2, James said, count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into manifold temptation. Well, he's not telling James to rejoice when you sin. No, temptation is not sinful, but it can lead to that which is sinful. So when I am being tested or tried, I see how that gold is refined by fire. And so when I'm being tested or tried, I need to count it all joy when I'm tested or tempted, when I overcome that temptation. Because you see, that makes me stronger. But James tells us about temptation. When he is drawn away by his lust, number two, the lust is conceived, and then it bears sin, and the result of sin is death. One, two, three. That's exactly what Achan said. I saw it. I coveted it. And then I took it. I acted upon that which was my desire. And I took the very thing that God said not to take. Now here's the kicker. He then said, I hid. I hid it in the midst of my tent. I tell you what, folks, when you do something that's wrong, those of you who are little, you do something that's wrong, and you know it's wrong, you really don't want somebody to find out about it, do you? When I was just a little fellow, I colored on my mother's hardwood floors. Now, I know that shocks you, but that's what I did. And I got a piece of paper, and I colored on that piece of paper, and I laid it over that spot on the floor. And I went and got my mama. And I told her, Mother, that piece of paper says, do not move. That's what it says. Now, what was it that I wanted? I wanted what I did to continue to be hidden. Now, most of you who are parents, if you came upon that little piece of paper and your child said, that says, do not move, you know what the very next thing's going to be that you do? You're going to move it. And what is it that you're going to find? You're going to find underneath it that which was intended to stay hidden. But you know what? Didn't stay hidden. Let me tell you about that. Didn't stay hidden. Neither did Achan sin. Now I want you to think about Achan. Achan said, I took these things. Can you imagine how wealthy and rich and proud he must have been in the privacy of his tent as he put that beautiful Babylonian garment about his shoulders? Maybe he dug up that bar of gold and the silver and let it kind of trickle through his fingers. Can you imagine how rich he must have felt? But he couldn't tell anybody. Because if he told somebody, it wouldn't stay hidden. You see, his joy was confined only to his tent. He couldn't go anywhere to tell anybody about it. And what is it that we do when we do something that we know is wrong? We want it to stay hidden, don't we? Just like Achan. Now, we've called Achan foolish. Now, why would you think Achan to be so foolish? Well, when we look at Eve and see what she did, and God raised the question, what did you do? As he spoke to Adam, Adam points his finger at Eve. That woman that you gave me, she gave to me, and I did eat. All right, Adam, or Eve, rather, what did you do? Well, Satan, you know what he did, how that he deceived me. And I ate the forbidden fruit. David, what did you do? Well, I lusted after another man's wife. What'd you do, David? Well, I brought her husband in and I tried to get him drunk so I could hide it. What'd you do, David? I gave instructions to her husband to carry to the captain of the army to put him out in the middle of the battle and to withdraw from him and let him be killed. What'd you do, David? I killed him. That's what it did. Now, why did David do all that? Well, he had committed sin and he wanted to hide it. Now, isn't that what we want to do? We talked about this morning how that we put on our best face and our tie and white shirts and all this kind of stuff and we come here so folks see us at our very best. Sometimes we want folks to see us that way simply because we want to hide who we are. And that's exactly what Achan did. Achan was a thief. And he brought dishonor unto Israel and dishonor unto God. And he wanted to hide it. But as we look in the New Testament, we find, for there is nothing hid, save that it should be manifest, neither was anything made secret, but that it should come to light. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 13 says, and there is no creature that is not manifest in His sight, but all things are naked and laid open before the eyes of Him with whom we have to do. In that day, when God shall judge the secrets of men, Paul said, according to my gospel by Jesus Christ. Somebody mentioned earlier, I think, that all-seeing eye, the song that we sometimes sing. The all-seeing eye watching you. Not a moment that you can live, breathe, eat, sleep, or anything else, but what God knows what you're doing. He knows even the thoughts and the intents of your heart. So as we look at what Achan did, did Achan really think that hiding these things in the midst of his tent was really going to accomplish anything? But you know, the sad part is, as we were discussing this morning with Lot, there were consequences that no doubt Achan had not considered. When you go back to the text of Joshua chapter 7, beginning in verse 22, it says, so Joshua sent messengers, and they ran into the tent, and behold, it was hid in his tent and the silver under it. And they took them from the midst of the tent and brought them unto Joshua and unto the children of Israel. And they laid them down before Jehovah. And Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, and the silver, and the mantle, and the wedge of gold, and his sons, and his daughters, and his oxen, and his asses, and his sheep, and his tent, and all that he had. And they brought them up into the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, why hast thou troubled us? Jehovah shall trouble thee this day. And all Israel stoned him with stones, and they burned them with fire, and stoned them with stones, and they raised over him a great heap of stones unto this day. And Jehovah turned from the fierceness of his anger. Wherefore the name of that place was called the Valley of Achor unto this day. Now I wonder if Achan had thought about any of those things. We might raise the question, what did Achan's poor decision do for him spiritually? Well, much like Lot, it corrupted him. What did the sin of Achan do for his family? Well, much like Lot, destroyed his family. And what did the sin of Achan do for him as far as his wealth was concerned? Well, in the privacy of his tent, we might say, well, that he was very rich. But in the end, he lost everything. Do we not see that? He lost the gold, he lost the silver, the mantle. He lost his oxen, his sheep, everything that he had, right down to his tent. It was taken out and destroyed. Now, do you see any similarities between Achan and Lot? But Lot is referred to as a righteous man who made some bad choices. I don't know how to describe Achan, but just plain foolish. He just made some foolish choices in light of all that he had seen, all that God had done. Achan's sin cost him everything. And certainly we see in this the consequences imposed upon others. When we compare that to David's sin, again, a lesson in and of itself, for lack of time, we'll not go there. But we know that when Nathan was talking to David about the sin that he committed, David spent the rest of his life suffering consequences for the sins that he committed with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. We know that there was war throughout David's life. We know that there was turmoil in his family. We know that his son raped David's sister. We know that another son set a plot to kill that son. And we know then that the son who killed that son plotted to take the kingdom away from David. Oh, it was a mess. And why? Because David saw this woman and he thought he had to have her. And my friend, there are always consequences, aren't there? Achan. There are perhaps many others that we could compare as like kinds with that of Lot. But Achan certainly fills the bill, doesn't he? Achan saw. He coveted. He took it. And then he hid it. But you see, the problem with every bit of that, it didn't stay hidden any more than my coloring on my mother's hardwood floor didn't stay hidden. You see, sin always has consequences. Always. Many of the consequences are quite severe. You've listened patiently to our study. Hope that it's been helpful. Hope both studies today have been helpful to us. To see qualities and characteristics in the lives of these men. To cause us to not want to be like them. To learn to see evidences of these flaws in our own character. And strive to correct those things before it's too late. As I look out over the audience, I want to remind you that if there's one present that would desire to obey the gospel, time and opportunity is now. You know what to do. We'd encourage you to do it. Do it quickly. Do it now. Everything is ready. Believing that Jesus is the Christ, turn from your sin. Confess your faith and be baptized into Christ. Maybe you've done that, and maybe some of the things we've talked about today have hit home, and you see areas that you need to correct. Friend, don't put it off. There might not be another time. But now is the time. And if we can help you by praying with you and for you to that end, then make that known while together we stand and sing this song.